This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. One of the bloodiest race riots of the 20th century took place in 1917 in East St. Louis, Illinois. Our guest this afternoon is journalist Harper Barnes, a longtime editor and critic for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. He is the author of Never Been a Time, the 1917 race riot that sparked the civil rights movement. The riot was one of many that occurred in the era of the First World War. Tens of thousands of African Americans headed from the South to the North for jobs created in a boom fueled by the war. As Harper Barnes reports, blacks arrived in northern cities by the trainloads, and many whites responded to the African American incursion with a horrific series of racial confrontations, riots, and massacres that broke out in cities across the nation. Barnes says the riot in East St. Louis was the deadliest, with at least 48 people, perhaps as many as 200 killed. The vast majority were black. The East St. Louis riot and others around the country were the impetus for civil rights organizations and civil rights actions that would be so important through the 20th century and into today. Listeners, I look forward to hearing your questions and comments this afternoon. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free number, that number 800-222-9455. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest, Harper Barnes. In addition to his work for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, he has written for the Atlantic Monthly, Rolling Stone, and the Washington Post. He is the author of three books. His new book, Never Been a Time, is published by Walker & Company. Again, the phone numbers, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Harper Barnes, good to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
You write about this riot in East St. Louis, but what is also interesting is that this was happening across the country.
Mm-hmm.
There were more than two dozen riots during this period.
During the World War
One
period.
And they're largely forgotten, but not totally forgotten. Tell us about Eugene Redmond and the title of the book.
Well, the title of the book refers to something said by the poet laureate of East St. Louis, Eugene Redmond, who's actually a nationally pretty well-known black poet, professor at Southern Illinois University at Edwardsville. He's professor emeritus now, I believe, and a poet and author. And Eugene took me on a tour of East St. Louis, which is his hometown. Eugene has been drawn back to East St. Louis time and again. He taught in California for a while and back east, but he keeps coming back to East St. Louis because of what he senses is the soul of the city. He calls the city East Boogie, like a lot of old-time residents of East St. Louis. And as he was taking me around in East St. Louis, showing me places where buildings had been raised in 1917 and had never been rebuilt, I asked him, I said, well, do people know about this? And he said, what he said confirmed pretty much what I had found out, which is that most white people in this area, and certainly nationwide, had never heard of the East St. Louis race riot. But he said it has remained alive in the black oral tradition. There's never been a time when it was not alive in the black oral tradition. And that's where I got the title of my book. And I think a lot of black history is like that. It's only in the last few decades that we've come to realize that much of black history is in the oral tradition and hasn't been up until now written down.
Yeah. Why do you suppose we're now ready to do this? We can talk a little bit later about the General Assembly in North Carolina in 2000 establishing a commission to find out what had happened in a riot that took place in Wilmington in 1908.
Right.
Why now? Why in the last 10, 20 years?
You know, I think several things have happened. Finally, in American life, the civil rights era has produced a very positive result, which is that throughout our country, throughout our businesses and government, and so forth, blacks are present as witness the recent election. And so I think blacks have become much more visible in this country. Blacks were invisible for decades. After the slaves were freed, slaves were kept in near slavery conditions. There's one of the recent books that I was inspired by was a book called Slavery by Another Name, about labor contracts in the South, where millions of blacks were basically kept in slavery until the Second World War. That's over to a great extent, and I think blacks have just become more visible. I also think that a younger generation has grown up free of some of the prejudices of the past, and is just more willing to appreciate these matters. And I just think the time has come finally to look back on these matters and understand what terrible things were done to black people in this country.
Yeah. Thinking about what you just said, you know, this business of invisibility, that really makes possible the violence, the injustice.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not, of course, as you know, one of the great, perhaps the greatest novel of black life in America is called Invisible Man.
Mm.
And I think that reflected a real truth in America. People just didn't see what was going on, and the riots of the riots of the World War I period, in which in city after city across America, blacks were basically slaughtered by whites, which is what took place in East St. Louis, in Chicago, in Washington, D.C., in Tulsa, in many other cities. And yet, 50 years later, the World War I was, of course, taught in schools. Everyone knew about World War I. Nobody knew about what was called the Red Summer of 1919, when at least a dozen cities broke out in anti-black riots. We didn't want to see it.
Well, at the close of the first chapter, you say this period was one of the most violent times in the history of the world.
Yeah.
And I found myself thinking, could that be true?
Well, I think so. And I thought about that a lot. But you've got to understand that the early part of the 20th century, the World War I killed millions. And that alone, because Genghis Khan didn't have the ability to kill millions of people. Mm. I mean, suddenly modern technology had made slaughter and genocide possible. And so there was violence all over the world, including in what was then called Palestine. The roots of many of our problems, the creation of the state of Iraq came out of World War I. It was an incredibly violent period, and it spawned violence that continued throughout the century.
Mm. And America's history, looking over your work here in this book, it is a violent one. Go back to the 19th century. There were all kinds of riots.
Yeah, there were riots about every... Americans were prone to riot about almost anything, from the taxes on whiskey to closing down brothels to what we would consider now to be minor differences in religious belief. That's still going on, of course, in much of the world. We were prone to riot. We were violent. We were a country raised in violence. We won our freedom with violence, perhaps justified violence, but at any rate, we were born in violence, and we've continued to be a violent people throughout our history.
Mm. W.E.B. Du Bois, you know, agonized over the racial violence.
Right.
What were the observations he made about the violence in his 1935 book, Black Reconstruction?
Well, that's a fairly general question. Let me try and answer it, and then you can direct me if I'm going in the wrong way. But he felt that that violence had been perpetrated against against blacks throughout their history. He understood, in a way, the violence as if it came. It came from. He said it came from fear.
Mm-hmm.
He seemed to even understand, in a way. He was a great man, one of the greatest men of the 20th century, I think, and he seemed to understand that the poor whites, who were the predominant predominantly violent people, as far as blacks were concerned, were tended to be poor whites, and he understood that they were people that were afraid. They were afraid they were going to lose their jobs to blacks. They were afraid that they were going to lose their lives. They believed terrible stories about blacks, and so he understood that. But he also, by then, had come to believe that perhaps the only way that blacks would be able to defend themselves was to take up violence themselves, and he hated to think that. But as he got older, he became more and more convinced. The phrase that became "by any means necessary" in the writings of Malcolm X originated in W.E.B. Du Bois.
Hmm. How were these riots talked about at the time and in the years that followed?
Great stress. The riots were justified at the time by rumors of almost mostly erroneous rumors of black terrible things that black people were doing, black rapes, black robberies and murders and so forth. And so for a while, the riots, although they inspired liberals and black civil rights groups to call for federal legislation to change the federal law, anti-lynching legislation was basically what many people called the riot in East St. Louis was a mass lynching. And anti-lynching legislation became introduced again, but was never passed. The blacks were blamed for it. In many cases, blacks were blamed for it, including in newspapers in St. Louis and across the country. It was an uprising against. The riots were considered to be uprisings against black criminals.
Hmm. And now let's bring in this situation in North Carolina that we mentioned a little bit ago, Wilmington, North Carolina. In 2000, the North Carolina General Assembly established a commission to find out what had happened in the riot that took place in Wilmington in 1908, I believe.
Yeah.
You want to tell us a little bit about that riot and what was said at the time, and then almost 100 years later, what the commission found to have happened?
The riot was once again an attack on blacks. What had happened almost miraculously in North Carolina was that populism, which had been a force that had been intertwined inextricably with racism in many parts of the South. In other words, the populists were also the blacks are causing our problems, basically, was what many Southern populists said. But in North Carolina, and particularly in the port city of Wilmington, which was North Carolina's, I believe, largest city at the time, blacks had actually achieved, blacks and populists in what was called a fusion movement, had actually achieved some elected power. And blacks were respected in the community. There was a black daily newspaper in Wilmington, North Carolina. There were black merchants. Blacks were very successful. And the powerful whites in the community just couldn't stand it. And I think part of the one big reason was that keeping blacks and poor whites from uniting disrupted their power, so that the old plantation owners and mill owners and so forth could stay in power. And so basically they roused poor whites to attack the blacks. And I don't know, in these riots the fatality figures are always questionable.
Mm-hmm.
Something like 100 blacks were killed, and thousands of blacks were driven out of Wilmington and never came back. It was not until almost a century later, that the North Carolina state legislature set up a commission to investigate the Wilmington riot, to interview the few survivors that they could find, and to go back over their records. And they described what had happened in Wilmington as a coup by white people, taking back the power that they thought they had lost. And it set in motion commissions in other states to investigate riots and to discuss the paying of reparations. As far as I know, no reparations have actually been paid in Wilmington. Reparations were paid in a case in Florida where a black town was essentially wiped out. And a couple of years ago, the Illinois State Legislature established a riot and reparations committee for the state of Illinois to investigate not just the East St. Louis riots, but the Springfield riot, which was a seminal event in black history in the 20th century, and the Chicago riot of 1919, and other racial riots, and report. And I note by my book that the report is due today.
Yeah.
And as far as I am able to tell, it has not yet been released, and I guess the Illinois legislature has other matters on its mind.
Oh, yeah. A lot on the table there. But right before airtime, I think as producer Harriet Williamson was talking to you on the phone, I went online to look, and as far as I can tell, this date, January 7th, 2009, it is here. The commission is to report no later than January 7th, 2009. But as far as I was able to determine from a quick look online, that report has not yet been issued, although it's 1:25 Central Time. So there are a few hours left in the day.
Yeah.
We'll see. I think it would be really a fascinating story. I hope it doesn't get lost.
Yeah, I do too.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, journalist Harper Barnes. He is the author most recently of Never Been a Time, the 1917 race riot that sparked the civil rights movement. That riot took place in East St. Louis, Illinois. What were the richest sources of information you came across in your research, given, you know, that it was some time ago and a lot of what we know or what we remember is remembered in the black community, and it's an oral record?
Yeah. Well, fortunately, there were sources. When I first started, I talked to some people who had actually survived the riot. They were people in their 90s, and including a couple of people who had suffered none of the diminution of age that some people do, and they were very eloquent about the riot, but they told me things that I didn't think happened. And then I looked, and one of the witnesses to the riot was the singer Josephine Baker, who watched it from the St. Louis bank of the river. She grew up in St. Louis. And her autobiography talks about the riot. And there's stuff in there that didn't happen, and stuff that even if it had happened, she wouldn't have seen. So I began to think, well, people's memories are, and I think this is true, people's memories are, to a great extent, affected by what they hear, so that a week or two after an event, you may remember things quite differently because what your neighbors told you and so forth. You can't quite remember what you witnessed and what you were told, what you read. So I went looking for historical documents, and I found in the St. Louis University Law Library and in other libraries, probably in the University of Illinois Library, there existed eight reels of microfilm on the riot. And the core of the document, the microfilm, is five reels of testimony given to a congressional investigating committee that came to East St. Louis 3 months after the riot. And hundreds of people were interviewed. And the transcript was preserved. It was not printed in the congressional record because it was a hearing outside of Congress, but it was the transcript was preserved in the National Archives. And the stories in there, anytime there's a quote in my book from the period, chances are it came from this transcript. It's an invaluable resource. And many, many blacks who were affected by the riot, some who were almost died, testified to their experiences, and did, as did many, many whites, including some white power brokers. And so that was the core of my research. In the wake of the riot, among the people who came to investigate were W.E.B. Du Bois, who came from New York to investigate for the NAACP, and Ida Wells Barnett, the great black feminist and anti-lynch activist, came down from Chicago. And both of them interviewed many people, and their statements, the statements they took, are preserved. So I was able to tell the story to a great extent in the words of people of the time.
Again, this is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest, Harper Barnes, author most recently of Never Been a Time, the 1917 race riot that sparked the civil rights movement. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll free, 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now. A listener in Champaign, line one. Hi.
Good afternoon. As always, a good topic, interesting. To me, it just one of the basic or underlayment of racism and prejudice is ignorance, and what manipulators of people do, and that's the typical racist, is that they also add the element of being poor to that, and they get people to hate each other that are in that kind of predicament. Your comment about the Wilmington situation only heightened that statement as far as I'm concerned. But it is just amazing, and I guess it's more a comment. It's amazing how ignorance and how we manipulate people to keep something as such a terrible institution to continue, although we've made big strides, quite frankly.
Yes, we have. Yes, we have. Yeah, it is amazing, and in some cases, I think you can very directly say that people with power in some areas used racism to divide people who, if they united, might unseat them from their seats of power. And certainly the black and the white racism in the South was, and in the North was that way, and perhaps in some cases continues to be that way.
Well, thank the listener for his call. Other questions, other comments are invited. 333-9455. That's 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, this, the call and the caller and then your response to his comment brings to mind the chapter East St. Louis and the Great Exodus, and there is an epigraph that opens the chapter where you quote the author of Made in USA, E. St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
In part, it reads, "Chicago needs Gary, and St. Louis needs East St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
What was the fellow who wrote Made in USA, East St. Louis getting at?
I think if you look at cities across America, there are satellite towns or cities that have been established to serve the major city, as East St. Louis was established. East St. Louis and its environs were established to serve St. Louis. For example, the stockyards were actually not in East St. Louis proper. They were in an unincorporated area just outside of East St. Louis. They established, not only did the powerful people in St. Louis establish industries that had unpleasant effects from a standpoint of pollution and from that alone, from a standpoint of polluting, not only did they establish it across the river, but they managed to establish it in its own little town, so they wouldn't have to pay taxes in East St. Louis. So every city has managed to establish these satellite towns where both polluting industries and vice flourish, as they did in East St. Louis and in the surrounding communities, and that's what he's talking about. These are communities that, in effect, are abandoned by the larger community and left to stew in their own rather rotten juices, I guess you could say. Jonathan Kozol, the great writer on education, came to East St. Louis in the 80s and basically just said that the citizens of East St. Louis had been abandoned by the power structure, which resided in not just in St. Louis, but in Chicago and New York as well. And this is what's happened with these small industrial cities throughout the nation.
Made invisible.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And what has happened to East St. Louis and many communities like it across the country is, beginning in the 1960s, the establishment of the interstate highway system has meant, it used to be you had to drive through. If you were going to go from St. Louis to Indianapolis, let's say, you had to drive through East St. Louis. Now you drive over East St. Louis, and it's another way that these people that and their poverty have been made invisible.
Hmm. Well, what was East St. Louis back at the turn of the century like? It was known, you say, as the Pittsburgh of the West, or, you say, perhaps less flattering, the Hoboken of St. Louis.
Yeah.
So what was it like?
Well, it was a predominantly white industrial city, but I must stress that most of the industry was not actually in the city limits of East St. Louis. Although the stockyards and the aluminum plant and the steel mill and the oil refinery, all of which were in separate little communities or unincorporated areas, used the services of East St. Louis, but they didn't pay taxes. But still, for the period, we were going through a period of great widespread industrialization. The population of the country was increasing, and so there were jobs to be had in East St. Louis. They didn't pay very well. Even the union jobs didn't pay very well, and the unions were pretty weak. But it was a working class city that worked pretty well. If you ignore the fact that it was run by a very corrupt political machine. There was widespread open gambling and prostitution. But on the other hand, the city had a certain lower middle class. It was a place where you could get a job. And the problems came after blacks started moving north during World War I, looking for their chance, for their piece of the American dream, in effect. But it was a wide open city, but a city with some money in it. People had a few bucks in their pockets. And then when the war came, and blacks arrived, and many of the whites just reacted as if it were an invasion.
Mm. When had African Americans begun to arrive in numbers in the St. Louis area?
Well, the first, as I say in the book, the first black of note to come to East St. Louis was a black musician named William Christopher Handy, W.C. Handy, who came before the turn of the century and was cheated in East St. Louis. He worked for 2 weeks with this guy who then wouldn't refuse to pay him. And he ended up sleeping on the banks of the Mississippi River. And that was the occasion one of the first times, if not the first time, he heard the music that came to be called the blues. And East St. Louis has a rich tradition of black music since then. But the first blacks, and blacks that had arrived around, there were blacks in around the turn of the century. By 1910, the black population of East St. Louis was maybe 10%. But everybody got along pretty well until the influx that came with after 1914 with the European War.
Okay. So with the arrival of African Americans, what were their immediate concerns and challenges? Were there opportunities there?
There were. The stockyards, which were, along with the aluminum manufacturing plant, were the two dominant industries, and they were hired for the more menial jobs. America was a land of opportunity then. There were immigrants from all over coming to places like East St. Louis, to industrial places like East St. Louis. And they tended to get hired for the most menial jobs. The blacks sort of came on the heels of the Eastern Europeans who immigrated in the late 18th or late 19th and early 20th centuries. So there was opportunity. And there was a thriving black community in downtown and in the area known as the South End, south of downtown. There were even blacks and whites were living not in the city was segregated more or less by block, but they lived very close to one another. Years later, Miles Davis grew up in East St. Louis,
mm-hmm.
and he recalled the situation, which must have been very, very much like it was. He recalled the situation before World War II, which I suspect was very much like it was before World War I, where blacks and whites lived together fairly comfortably, and he played with with white kids, and there was a soul food restaurant and a Greek hardware store next door to each other. And so I think it was like that until the great exodus from the South.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Harper Barnes, author of Never Been a Time, the 1917 Race Riot that Sparked the Civil Rights Movement. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Let's take another call. A listener in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Interesting program. Wanted to bring it a little closer to home here, literally. I know in the late 40s, early 50s, there General Motors built a large foundry on the south side of Danville in Tilton area. And they hired a lot of young black men in the south for what seemed to be good wages down there and brought them up by CNEI and IC Railroads to Danville to work, and that caused a rather social imbalance situation. You had all these young guys who were away from home and didn't have their families around there and anything, and I know my father and some other people got together and started a community center called Lorelei Fellowship House, which recently, a few years ago, had its 50th anniversary, and that was an effort to integrate these people into the community and try to take the head of steam off of it, because Danville is very much a it was particularly in an industrial working class town.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we didn't have any riots at that point in time because of that influx there. But that kind of thing, you know, happened closer to home. I wouldn't be surprised at what that happened in Decatur with some of the industries that were over there, too. So this fluid population is always a problem. In Danville's case, things calmed down a little bit as girlfriends and wives, you know, started following the
yeah.
money up here and began establishing themselves as a community. But those problems were evident, you know, around here, and as you say, on North and Gary and other places too. So none of us are very far away from it.
No, I mean, it's a problem. It's an ongoing problem. I mean, the reaction against Hispanic workers today in various cities reflects that. One of the things that happened in East St. Louis that I don't think would have happened in Decatur was that there was a great deal of labor tension in East St. Louis, and there were unions that were on the verge of going on strike, or actually on strike against large corporations, against the three-car company, against the aluminum company. There had even been strikes in the stockyards. And every time there was a threat of a strike, industrialists in East St. Louis would send labor contractors to the South to bring up workers, to bring up black workers as replacement workers for whites who were either on strike or who were fired for union activity. And this, of course, greatly exacerbated the tension. And even after there were a sufficient number of people in East St. Louis, black and white, to fill all the jobs, some of these industries apparently kept sending labor contractors down to the South, because the more people they had, the less they had to worry about labor demands. And so there was testimony in the hearings that I discussed, the congressional hearings that I discussed, that even 3 months after the riot, while the hearings were being held, the railroads were still bringing blacks up, promising them jobs, and then reneging on the promises, so that you created a great deal of social unrest. And there were a lot of single men, and it's true, there were a lot of single men that were brought up, and the problem was made worse by the fact that there were no jobs for them, or the jobs they were offered paid half of what they had been told. So you had, I mean, it's understandable that white workers would have been resentful of these practices. It's just that they, as I see it, they took their anger out on the wrong people.
Mm. Does a listener want to follow up?
No, it's one brief comment. I was in Chicago working as a social worker in 1966 when we had the major riot up there. And, sometimes columnists, anyway, printed a column a few days later pointing out, like, one of the prior major riots in Chicago was when the Irish, who controlled city government, tried to close down the taverns on Sunday, and all the Germans and the German tavern owners marched on downtown, and basically they got stopped because they raised all the bridges. But he was pointing out that different groups have been involved in this, as you'd mentioned earlier, over time.
Oh, wow. I mean, it's no question about it. I mean, you go through the history of riots in America, and you're just astonished. I mean, while blacks were still enslaved, and before many of them had moved to the North, there were riots between Catholics and Protestants. Between Irish Catholics and Irish Protestants, in fact, between, as you say, Germans and the Irish. Later, there were outbreaks of violence against Italians when they moved into cities. This goes back to the early days of the Republic.
Mm. Speaking of the press, I want to thank the listener for his call. Speaking of the press, also leading up to the riot in East St. Louis were some sensationalist stories in papers. Sensationalist reports.
There was a couple of newspapers, including the East St. Louis Journal, which reported on black crime in what you have to think of as an inflammatory way. I mean, I'm not saying that, as a former newspaper man, I'm not saying that a newspaper shouldn't report on crime. But there was one particular instance where a holdup by a black man took prominence on a page in the East St. Louis paper over a kidnapping and beheading by white gangsters. So the black crime was really emphasized, and the stories even in some of the local papers at the time of the riot basically blamed the blacks for the riot, even though the blacks were essentially helpless before the white onslaught. There were the newspapers did, some of them did not help. Now, as I say in the book, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch and the St. Louis Globe-Democrat both covered the riots and the events leading up to it as far as I can tell very honestly and even courageously in the case of the Post-Dispatch. The yellow journalism didn't go through everything, but every one of the newspapers, but some of the papers did just shameful reporting on emphasizing black crime over white crime.
Before we're out of time, let's take another call. A listener in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Mr. Barnes, thank you, or Dr. Barnes, as the case may be.
I wish.
There's always, it seems to me, as an amateur ethnomusicologist, a soundtrack for race riots. For example, yesterday was Epiphany, the 12th night of Christmas, and traditionally in Europe, for at least three centuries, that was the time when the priests would rile up the peasantry and start a pogrom, you know, let's kill a Jew for Jesus. And then, of course, we have the example of the hymn Amazing Grace, composed by Captain Nelson, who was a converted Anglican, where he composed it to give an anthem for the slaves that were brought from the slave ship who were still alive,
right,
but were suffering diseases, to be thrown overboard, and they sang Amazing Grace to. And I'm just wondering, in your research, what in race riots, you don't have music going on during race riots. I mean, lynchings were very, you know, they were done very nicely. You know, you sang the hymn, then you kicked the horse out from under the noose. Race riots are a different thing, but the music's done before or afterwards. And if you found any connection there, and I appreciate the previous caller on the religion question, and I'll let you go. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah. I don't know of any connection between the music and the riot. There was no radio, for what that's worth. Some churches that tried to alleviate the deplorable conditions in East St. Louis for blacks, in particular the First Baptist Church, whose minister was a real crusader and who warned the mayor of East St. Louis several times that if attacks on blacks continued in the streets of East St. Louis as they'd been going on for months, that sooner or later a riot was going to break out. So the only religious aspect I know of it was that among those who were trying to prevent a riot were a group of clergymen.
Okay. I've got one last question I want to get in, and I can give you about a minute tops. As I mentioned in my introduction, The riot in East St. Louis and others around the country were the impetus for civil rights organizations mm-hmm. and civil rights actions that would be so important up through our day here in the very early days of the 21st century. How important was East St. Louis in really kick-starting the civil rights movement? Because it was back following the riot in Springfield in 08 and Wilmington in 08 that the NAACP was founded.
Yeah, I think the two most important events in the history of the civil rights movement, at least in the early part of this century, were the riot in Springfield in 1908, which did lead to the establishment of the NAACP, and the riot in East St. Louis in 1917, which led to the first major civil rights march, which was 8,000 to 10,000 blacks marched down Fifth Avenue calling for a federal investigation of the riot and anti-lynching legislation. So, sadly and ironically, it seems to take tragedy to move us, or at least in those days it did, to
yeah.
move us.
I think you quote Du Bois in the book as saying something to the effect that I must leave my library. I must go and become active. Something like something
yeah,
like
my,
that.
Yeah, my litany or whatever. Yeah, yeah. I've forgotten the quote.
Yeah.
Yeah, where he had to become active.
Yeah. There we've got to leave it. We're out of time. Harper Barnes, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Harper Barnes is the author of Never Been a Time, the 1917 race riot that sparked the civil rights movement. The book is published by Walker and Company.